few races didn't turn out the way we would have liked. But we will be judged by if we get back up and what we do moving forward. And that's what tonight and every day between now and November 2018 is all about.
Yeah.
So I'm here to introduce a very good friend of mine. He's a state representative. He's an attorney. He's a father. He's a lieutenant colonel in the Army Reserves. But I want to tell you about the Todd Pritchard that I am. I met Todd in 2005. He was then Captain Pritchard. I was Sergeant Mallard.
Yeah.
Yes, sir.
Todd was my company commander. And we were getting ready to deploy to Iraq. And you might imagine it was a very difficult time, but I got to see Todd up close and to see who he is. And we deployed to Iraq with the Iowa National Guard. That was a very trying deployment. So 23 months deployment start to finish. There were some very difficult days. We didn't bring every Iowa and every American home with us. I've seen Todd under tremendous pressure. I've seen Todd in life or death situations. I trusted Todd with my life. He is a tremendous leader. He has great judgment. He knows what his values are. He knows what's important. His entire career, in one way or another, has always been serving the people of Iowa. And right now, we've got a big fight ahead of us. Todd is a fighter. I've seen him fight. He's going to keep fighting. He's a tremendous leader, and I trust him. And I'm glad to introduce my good friend Todd Pritchard.
Good afternoon.
I'm just going to leave it to what Jim said.
That was about as nice introduction as I could hope for, so thank you.
It was my pleasure when Jim ran
to give him that introduction, and that was nice, so thank you. Jan Pearson walked in.
But I'm going to talk a little bit about a couple of things. One, I am considering a run for governor. And so this is part of that kind of due diligence for me, to get out and talk and to listen about what the issues are. And the encouraging thing for me is that this type of activism, I see these crowds all over the state, and it's encouraging. Because what's happening in the State House right now, They're not our values, are they?
No.
They're not Iowa values. And Marie and Janet know that as well as I do. And you guys know that. And people are seeing that we're not valuing people and honest, hard work. It's not valued here. You know, I think that tweet that showed the governor signing the guy's collective bargaining. That tweet. Where he signed it in private, I think that kind of says it all.
Yeah.
You know, pictures say 1,000 words.
Yeah.
And that one probably said about 10.
Yeah.
So what I want to talk to you a little bit tonight is I'm going to talk just a little bit about myself, because my name ID, if you read the register, my name ID is low. I'll talk a little bit about myself and my background, and talk a little bit about what direction I think the party needs to go, and what we need to talk about to get our base back, and where we need to focus our energy to get back in power, to get back to Terraceville, to get back control of the Senate, and get back in control of the House. We need to reverse. And we can stop this hemorrhaging of our values. And we can reverse this trend to take our state back.
Yeah.
So a little bit about myself. I grew up in Davenport, Iowa, on the West End. If you know the West End, it's kind of a badge of honor for us West Enders. We call ourselves the West Enders. It's a very blue-collar, working-class part of the city. If you know anything about the Quad Cities and Davenport, you know that we used to be the Detroit of tractors, right?
Yeah.
When I was a kid, we had Case, Caterpillar, we had International, and we had John Deere. And about the only one left in a significant way is John Deere. And that happened when I was a child, in the 80s, when I was a teenager. And so my neighborhood, everybody's dad was worked at Alcoa, biggest aluminum mill in the world. They worked at one of the tractor factories, and they worked at a foundry. And there were people that wore work boots, they had sunburned faces, they had rough hands, and they wore work coats to work, right? And my parents fit right in. My family fit in, even though my dad was a Republican. He did vote for Mondale. But my parents were carpet cleaners. And so we ran a carpet clean service out of our house. And my job after school and in the summers was to lift buckets, carry the water to and from the machines. I was free labor for my folks. And my dad was kind of passionate about local politics. He wasn't a partisan. He's 86. He'd probably be considered an Eisenhower Republican. He was very passionate about local politics and local issues. And that rubbed off on me. And he didn't really care about money. So he didn't have a lot of money. So I went to the University of Iowa, graduated high school from Davenport West. And usually the crowd will have like, is there anybody from Davenport graduated Davenport West?
90.
Oh, yes.
93.
Teacher there.
Were you really?
Oh, yeah.
See, it's a small world.
The St. Ambrose Cowboys.
Well, tonight will count.
Davenport
Central.
We gotta draw a line somewhere.
You spent a lot of money in there.
And we thank you for that. So in 93 I graduated. I went to the University of Iowa and studied local science and history, and I joined the Army. About halfway through, I kind of decided, you know, I'd always kind of wanted to serve, and I decided when I was a junior in college, I was going to serve. So I joined the Army. Went to basic training, I enlisted, and I remember how worried my mom was. They're going to send you to Bosnia. They're going to send you to Bosnia. If only they had sent me to Bosnia. But, joined ROTC and then I commissioned in the Army in 1998. And I spent 3 years on active duty, Fort Hood, Texas, with the first cab. If you've ever seen like Apocalypse Now, you remember the surfing? That was my battalion. That was us. And I wore the big yellow patch on the shoulder. And really had an interesting view on the world. You know, you go overseas and live in different parts of the country, it really kind of opens your eyes. And opened my eyes to say, I want to come back to Iowa. And that's where I want to raise my family, is here. Because you see how good our public education was, how friendly our people are. This is the place where I wanted to be. And I remember my first weekend back, I came back to start law school, and it was law school at Iowa City. One of my first weekends back, me and a friend are canoeing on the Cedar River between, like, outside of Davenport, where, and actually it was the Wapsie River. Maybe I shouldn't tell this story because you're like, we canoe down a few miles, and then we're like, how are we gonna get back? And there was a couple fishing on the bank, and the lady said, we said, hey, can you give us a ride back to our car? It's about 2 miles upstream. She said, you know what? Just take the keys. You know, she didn't know us from anybody. Yeah. She's, you know, I told myself, that's Iowa.
Yeah.
And it's good to be home. This lady doesn't know me, but she trusts me with her car keys to drive back, you know, and that's Iowa, right? That's Iowa Max. Last week wasn't Iowa Max.
No.
It wasn't Iowa. It's Iowa garbage is what it was. Thank you. It reminded me of a story, all right? So I'm going to talk about Johnson School. I went to Johnson. Did you go to Johnson?
Williams.
Okay. So I went to Johnson, kind of right, kind of towards the center of Davenport, a very working class town. And I remember, like, there'd be the school play or musical, right? Or there'd be a sporting event. Remember when you were a kid, remember how your parents or the parents of all your classmates would come and they'd stand against the back of the wall in the auditorium and they'd just beam with pride as they watched their children sing in a musical or play the violin or something like that. You know, in my community, in my neighborhood, they wore, like I said, you know, they worked at the factory. And they wore work boots, blue jeans, they had work on their hands, and they had a sunburned face, right? Those were the people that I grew up around, that I respected, and they raised families in Davenport. Those are the same people that came to the gallery last week, and they watched in probably tears as their state government voted to take away their voice in the workplace.
Yeah.
People who stand on the side of the road, avoiding traffic to patch potholes, snowplow our roads, go into these homes to try to save a child in a bad situation, and they watched. They watched as out-of-state interests won that day, and people who work for a living lost.
Yeah.
And they watched. And that's not right.
No.
So here we are, right? These are dark times for a Democrat, right? We're a victim of what I call the trifecta.
We're human beings.
Right. Yeah. You're right. And I saw a good sign that, you know, said, worker rights are human rights.
Yeah.
You know? Why do we have to apologize for somebody who makes a decent middle class living? Why do we have to apologize for that? These people aren't overpaid. They're not.
Most of them have college degrees.
Right. They're actually underpaid if you do the comparison. You know, the statistics, I think the percentage is about 17% comparable.
Yes.
So, you know, these are dark times. And so for, you know, we don't really control anything as Democrats. We don't really control any lever of power, right? We don't have the Senate, we don't have the House, we don't have the governor's office. So at this point I tell another story, because this brings to mind another story. It gets back into the Army. This is before Jim and I were in Iraq. I was in the regular Army with the 1st Cav, right? And we got deployed in 2000 to Kuwait. And in 2000, you remember, this is before the invasion of Iraq in 2003. Saddam Hussein is still in power. And we were deployed. I think there were 1,500 or 1,200 1st Cav soldiers deployed to the northern desert of Kuwait. And our job was to be a deterrent force, and our job was to buy 5 days, right? And so the Department of Defense had a plan on how to buy 5 days. You know, basically, you know, they brief us that, you know, if the Iraqis attack, and they would outline on the map, you know, there's two divisions of Iraqis. We don't know quite how many thousands of Iraqis, but more than you have. There's Iraqis here. If they attack, this is what we think they're going to do, and this is how we're going to react, right? This is what we're going to do. So as all war stories go, I have to say, so there I was, right?
Yeah.
I was 25 years old, an infantry lieutenant, and I was responsible for 32 soldiers. So I had my marching orders from my higher headquarters. My boss had said, that's what you're going to do, Lieutenant. Get ready, in case it happens, get ready. So I go down to the tent where my soldiers are, and I have my five squad leaders and platoon sergeant, right? Five NCOs, sergeants, like kind of like Jim. They're all older than me, you know, they're in their early 30s or late 20s or even their, you know, maybe mid 30s. They're all old guys, you know, 25 years old. They're ancient. And they all have families, right?
Yeah.
And they have soldiers that they're responsible for to bring home.
Yeah.
That they've got to account for. And so I say, you know, this is what we're going to do. This is what the Iraqis look like and what may happen to us. I said, this is what we do, and we're supposed to buy 5 days. They said, well, sir, what if it doesn't work? What if five days isn't long enough? What if we don't get reinforced in 5 days from the United States? What if we're overwhelmed? And I've been in a lot of forums with constituents, but I've never been in one that tough, right? Because these soldiers are depending on me to have an answer. They're depending on me to get them home, right? So you kind of pause for a minute, because I wasn't expecting that question, right? I thought they'd just kind of see the plan and understand that it's going to work. But what do we do if it doesn't work? Well, we fight. We fight through it. And we don't give up, because giving up and not going home and leaving soldiers behind is not an option. We're in the same boat. Our backs are against the wall right now. Right?
Yes.
We don't know how many bills are going to come across the border in the next few weeks, but they're going to ruin this state.
Yes.
And we're going to fight.
Yes.
And that's what we're going to do. And we're not going to give up.
No.
And I can see that here, because that's why all you people are here on a Thursday night to hear some state representative who might run for governor from Charles City.
Yeah.
Because we need somebody to fight.
Yes.
And if I run, that's what I'm going to do. Okay? Yes. Last story, okay? And it's where I think our message ought to go. And what I think we ought to be focused on to get back our voting base. And so this story, some of you may have heard it, but it's a personal story. And when I was a kid, I'll back up. So I grew up in Davenport, about 13, 14 years old. I come home from school. And the house is empty. I'm the first one home. I beat my sister home, and I beat my parents home. I'm sitting on the couch, and I'm watching TV. And all of a sudden, I have a really sharp pain, which I think now I have kidney stones. And if you've ever had that, I think it felt like an ice pick, right? It really felt like just a piercing pain. And I was just immobilized, right? I couldn't move. I literally could not get off the couch. I couldn't do anything. And my parents come home, and they're like, "What's wrong with you? What's up?" And I said, I don't know, And I was scared. And I said, I want to go to the doctor. And my dad was in anguish. You know how a parent, you see your child, he's just in anguish. And he's kind of upset, and he's just, remember pacing back and forth in the living room. And he goes to where he kept the checkbook. You remember those big checkbooks that had the three pages? He pulls that checkbook out, and he's like, "He's going to take me to the doctor." And my mom, who kind of ran the household, said, "There's no money. There's no money to go to the doctor. We can't take him to the doctor." Because, that probably would have cost over $1,000 in the 80s. That we didn't have that type of money, right? And so I gutted it out, right? I just toughed it out, and thankfully, sometime in the night, it passed, right? And I always tell, when I used to tell that story to friends and stuff, I would tell it from my perspective, that I was in a lot of pain, and that really hurt, and it felt like an ice pick. But when I became a father, and I have three children, have you ever been in an emergency room or a doctor's office with a child who's in pain or sick or suffering?
Yes.
Is there a worse feeling as a parent?
No.
And so then I rethought that story from my mom and my dad's perspective, right? And you think how hard that was for my dad to watch his 13-year-old son not know what's wrong and not be able to do anything about it, right? Those people, my dad had no hope. We didn't have insurance, we didn't have money, we had no place to go. We lost those people in those situations in 2016. Because we didn't deliver a message of hope. That no matter what happens, we as Americans, we as Iowans take care of each other. And we fight, right? And we have each other's back. And that there's going to be a way that you can raise your family and provide for your family. And at the end of the day, justice will prevail.
Yes.
Right? And so, what I'm here to talk about then is a message of hope and fighting for that hope. And to give those working families, those Iowans across this state who left us because we didn't provide hope, that hope that we're going to deliver for them. And that's why, all of you activists here, it's so critical that you sign up new voters.
Yes.
That you door knock.
Yes.
That in some cases you even donate, right?
Yes.
And then we get out of the comfort zones, because I can guarantee a couple of things. One, you guys are going to vote for these people, right?
Yeah.
But we can't guarantee that a Democrat's going to win in districts not too far west of here, not too far east of here, north and south, right? And so we need you to get out of your comfort zone a little bit and get out and hit the streets.
Yes.
And hold these people accountable and throw the bums out.
Yeah.
Right?
So that's my message. And I thank you all for letting me speak here. Is the forum, or is it kind of a question and answer format after this?
Yeah, please. We'd love to do questions. Yeah. Any questions for the representative?
Kelly does.
Kelly.
So my question is, I'm in the advocacy world, and we always talk about the power of numbers and how it can make a difference. But what I'm seeing in this state is the power of numbers is not making a difference, and it's money. How do we overcome that?
Yeah.
Literally, that's the million-dollar question, right? I mean, we get outspent, what, 3-1, 2-1 in some races, and then this message, you know, they tend to go negative first, right?
Yeah.
Then they hit them with this negative message. One, we have to raise money, okay? That's just part of the deal. It costs money to advertise and get our message out. Two, we can combat that with a grassroots effort, right?
Yes.
What's more powerful than you energize volunteers with truth on your side?
Yeah. Nothing.
I mean, the facts are on our side.
Yes.
Absolutely, they're on our side. And so we need to mobilize networks. We need to mobilize social media. We need to do all of the above, you know, for things that don't necessarily cost a lot. But we also need to play in that realm. You know, I mean, there's just no question.
Because our facts are not alternative.
Right, yeah. Right.
Other questions for the representative?
Right behind you. So I know what a lot of us kind of get frustrated with is that we are so based in facts and that it's so hard to sit and just say something that is the truth and have it be denied. Do you have, I guess, the awareness that there's also the need to tap into the emotion, and that's what the Republicans have mastered, is the fear, the words, the phrases, and the emotion.
Right.
What do you see us doing? I mean, obviously grassroots and talking
right.
One-on-one, but using the emotion in a positive way,
right.
Unlike the Republicans.
I mean, what we need to do as Democrats, and that's why, you know, I talk about like getting back to what I consider kind of our base, you know, working Iowans. I mean, you know, in my neighborhood, in the 80s, I mean, Republicans would lose 4-1, all right? And it's because those working Iowans, those families understood that Democrats were gonna take care of their interests, all right? And they were looking out for them. And so what our message has to be is that working Iowans, I don't like saying everyday Iowans, but just Iowans, right? We are protecting your interests. We share your values, and we're protecting your interests. And the fact of the matter is, we do. You know, and if you look at, this Planned Parenthood debate, right?
Ooh.
We own that issue, right?
Yes.
Collective bargaining, we own that issue. The facts are all on our side. Public education, funding for community colleges, job training, region universities, we own these issues,
yes.
You know, and these scare politics, which they love to play, you know, I was kind of at ground zero in my district, right? Because I had Mary Jo Wilhelm, who was a fabulous senator, and what did they ran all these fear negative ads that were just completely bogus, right?
Yeah,
you know, I'm not even going to describe it, because they were insulting.
But that's how we lost. Played into those fears and emotions.
Yeah.
But you know, but we didn't have an energized base, okay? And we didn't have a base that was coming to our aid, because they got kind of in doubt as to what was really going on.
Yeah.
And I think that if we can just, you know, because I won, right? Even in this bad year, I was the only Democrat on my ballot to win. Hi, all. Yeah. See, I mean, the reason I bring that up is because I didn't lose my base, right? I mean, I think the reason I won is that the people of Floyd and Chickasaw County realize that Todd is a hard worker and Todd's taking care of us, and they identified with that, right? And it probably helped that they didn't spend $1 million to unseat me. You know, I can't take all that credit, but because, you know, part of this game is luck too. But we've got to get back to our base. We've got to get connecting on those values that you can trust us to take care of it. That when your family and your job is in danger and you need, you know, you need to be retrained or you need assistance, we have your back. And we let too much doubt, and then they came in with this negative fear politics, and they took it over. We're always, you know, the fact of the matter is, we always are outspent, and we probably always will be outspent. But you know, we can still want to win, even if we don't have the biggest campaign budget. You know, it's just a matter of connecting. Sir.
Over the last 30 years, we've lost a lot of our base. We're a solid blue state, now we're pretty much a red state. And I think some of that has to do with the fear that Trump did, but I think most of it has to do with the fact that we haven't spread our message to the rural areas. We've got the I-80 corridor locked down, that's our shit. That is us.
Right.
Rural area voted red this year.
Yeah.
Right. How do you plan on getting out to them? How do you plan on getting our message out to them?
Well, those are my neighbors, right? I mean, I'm from Charleston. I mean, it's my adopted hometown. It's where I'm at. You know, and the thing that we need to realize, you know, is I call kind of the north end of, and Chris Hall is here today, too.
Hey, Chris.
Listen, this is, Charles City is a lot like Davenport. Charles City had the first gasoline mass production tractor factory in the country, if not the world. And what they did in Charles City from like 1908 up until 1993 was build Oliver and then what became White tractors, right?
Yeah.
And then that industry went away. And then we've had to rebuild. So now we build Winnebagos, we have chemical plants, what else do we have? We have a tire factory. We're still a working class, blue collar labor market, right? And what I notice when I moved to Charles City is that Charles City is just like the west end of Davenport. You know, then a few years ago I was saying I was knocking on the south side for Representative Brian Meyer when he first got elected. The south side is really like Charles City, right? And these issues aren't so much urban and rural as they are working family issues.
Okay.
You know, and if we can reach out to working family problems, right? People who are struggling paycheck to paycheck, we're gonna reach out to urban and rural. Because, you know, there still are farmers, but there's not as many farmers as there used to be, you know, 50 or 100 years ago. It's working class, working family issues. Sir.
A comment. I live in Des Moines, but I've been working in upstate for the last 5 years. Parked in a field at the corner of Interstate 35 and Highway 210. Highway 210 exit. It's a big tractor trailer, or a big trailer. It says stop eminent domain abuse.
Yeah.
Dakota Access Pipeline cut a diagonal swath across the Iowa.
Yeah.
And there were a lot of farmers, rural Iowans, that got steamrolled by eminent domain handing over their right of way, their property, to corporate. I'll bet you that there's not a lot of those farmers that go out that would identify as Democrats. There's probably some of them, not a lot of them. But they got stepped on by Branstad's Public Utilities Commission.
Yeah.
Those people can be our allies.
Wow.
Yeah.
You're going to get the right message.
Yeah. You know, my mother grew up on a farm, my wife grew up on a farm, my father grew up in a farm business, and I worked, you know, as a child in the summers with my family. It was kind of a thing to do, and I helped my father-in-law farm. I'm kind of the street help. And so, you would be surprised. I mean, I think there's a myth that all farmers vote Republican. It's not necessarily true. You know, and that issue in particular with the pipeline, that's got a lot of farmers, you know, talking about property rights and, you know, how can I lose, you know, how can this be taken away from me and things like that. But I think when you talk about reaching to, you know, kind of like this gentleman's question here about farmers and rural areas, how do you reach them? I really think it goes to just those basic pocketbook type issues and those working issues, those working family issues. Farming right now, you know, 3-4 years ago, it was just high. You know, it was grain prices were around $6 a bushel for corn. Now they're around $3.40. You know, and it's tough for farmers. And we need to be there and say, you know what, we're going to help you through this. All right. You know, my father-in-law, my mother's cousins who farmed up in Northwest Iowa. When I first got the invitation, it said Northwest Dems. I thought, Northwest Iowa Dems, right. Because in Sioux County, the Northwest Iowa Dems is a family reunion for me. But it's going to be to that message that we've got your back. And we're not going to let you fail. On the way here, I had one of my clients, right? Young farmer, maybe 33 years old. He's losing his farm, right? He's got small children. He's got a young wife. He's trying to raise hogs and grow corn and soybeans to support a family. And he's trying to avoid foreclosure, right? And what, you know, my message to him is you gotta keep fighting, right? And he says, run for governor and stop this, right?
Yeah.
And that's what they want. They want somebody that's going to say, all right, we're going to help you through this. Right? They can be reached.
Yeah.
Sir.
One of the things that contributed to the Republican landslide this fall was their adept use of the dog whistle. They spoke of crying. Everybody knew they meant black people, Hispanic people, and others. You know, they spoke of economic competition and that kind of thing for jobs. Everybody knew they meant black people. How should we address the issue of race, or should we address it at all?
Head on. We address it head on. We address it head on. There's no room for that in this country. And that gets back to our values. What makes this country great with our diversity, right?
Yes.
You know, and you know, my parents my ancestors came from Ireland and Germany. People came from all over the world, and that's what makes this country great. And those values are under attack, right? This isn't a sexist or racist society. And our strength is our diversity. We attack it head on. No question. There's just no question.
Thanks for being here. I've got a picture here on my phone. I know you can't see it, but I can tell you what, I describe it a little bit about what happened here. It has to do with the collective bargaining. And what happened with the collective bargaining bill?
What happened was you spoke at the public forum, and you did an excellent job.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Excellent job.
After the governor signed the bill, in quote, private, someone asked to have his picture taken with the governor. And there is the head lobbyist for Americans for Prosperity, which is the PAC for ALEC, American Legislative Exchange Council. So my question is, Through this whole thing with collective bargaining, I felt like one of the room renters on that patio has that tsunami in Indonesia wiped out the whole city. What we're dealing with is bigger than the state of Iowa. It has to do with the American Legislative Exchange Council, which is nationwide. And so that dark money is influencing the politics here in Iowa. What can we do as Democrats and as elected members of our legislature do about this influence of dark money in our politics?
What we do is we put light on it, right?
Yes.
And it gets into this, I mean, Citizens United case.
Yeah.
It's horrible, and I think we're dealing now with its results, you know.
Yeah.
And what we do is we put light on this dark money, right? We expose it. We were at a forum, Amanda Reagan, Senator Reagan, and Sharon Stackman, who are, you know, we're kind of the North Iowa three amigos for Democrats. And we were at a forum, what was it, a week and a half ago. We had over 200 people at the library in Mason City. And Mason City, my wife always says, it's River City from the Music Man. We had trouble in River City, right? And Alec came up. And a gentleman got up and he talked about Alec. And he gave a nice presentation, kind of like what you did about what Alec is and what it does, right? And the crowd didn't really know about that. Most, I think many of them, if not most of them, had never heard of it.
Yeah.
And then he got up and he sat down and I said, and oh, by the way, Linda Hoffmeyer is the past president of that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And Terry
Branstad. Right. And the crowd went, ooh. And it gasped. It was a collective gasp from the crowd.
Yeah.
Because I, like I said, I don't think people realized that, you know, a local state representative was so involved in this organization that really we don't know a lot about. Remember when our first year, remember we couldn't figure out if we were all members of ALEC?
No.
You know, because
they your dues.
Yeah, they made us
whether you want to or not.
Yeah.
Pay your dues.
Yeah. So I looked for my car because I wanted to burn it. But we've got to put light on it.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
That's what this is about. That's what this eight. That's what, you know, this and 18, that's why we need this activism.
Yeah. So it's not the number one issue. It's got to be enlightenment about what ALEC is and what they're doing.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm a retired teacher, and I know that there's a strong network that we can link into right now with the rural schools. My niece is a non-political teacher in Harlan, and she went to a meeting in Harlan and took the mic and talked to Schultz and Holt, Wesley and Dennison, and she surprised herself because that passion that she has for teaching is endangered now. And as our schools will suffer, and they will because of this, it's going to open people's minds. It's going to shed the light that we're talking about,
right.
And that's definitely a link that we can and should get to. Right now.
Well, and you know, my wife teaches. My wife is a talented, gifted teacher. She used to be a second grade teacher at Van Meter. And she's been a talented, gifted teacher for second through eighth graders in Charles City. And they're just in a panic, you know, because they're texting me back. They signed a contract an hour and a half before that picture was taken.
Yeah.
And thank God they did, right? But we've got the attention of these educators now, because now their livelihood, their profession, their ability to provide health care for their family is in danger.
Yes.
And that's a serious situation that will grab attention, right?
Yeah.
And you know what we need is we need not a flash in the pan activism. Because this isn't over. We need a slow burn activism. Right? And then it needs to come to fruition at 18 and then sustain itself.
Yes.
Because this is what happens. We have an election like 16, you know, and we 14 was not a great election for Democrats. 10 was not a great election for Democrats.
Yeah.
But that's what happens when good people don't pay attention, right? And we've got to kind of fight this. What was the word we always said that kills in Iraq?
Complacency
kills, right? Complacency. And we need to be the stewards of this state.
And I think it will happen. I had lunch with my good Republican friend today, and she said, "Okay, Lori, I got to tell you, I didn't vote for Hillary, but I didn't vote for Trump, and I it's okay." And I said, "Oh, you're welcome." And she said, "Well, we got to do something about this. I will legislate." And that's a long time Republican who is awakening to what's happening out there. Yeah.
So. My neighbor Monday night came over especially to apologize to me because he said, "Mike, I'm really sorry. I didn't know what I was doing. I voted for Trump. I didn't think that these Republicans were going to do what they really said they were going to do." And so they're starting to apologize for their vote. So we've got some momentum here.
Well, and you know what? I think what also happened, like in my district, is the top of the ticket affects the ticket the whole way through, right? And so we need to emphasize to voters across the state that, you know, as Tip O'Neill said, politics is local. You know, that's one thing I always tell when students come to the Capitol or something. You know, I always say, what goes on in your county courthouse and what goes on in this state house affects your life a lot more than what happens in D.C. on a day-to-day basis. You know, and that, in you know, hopefully what happened last week and what's going to happen over the next few weeks will help us remind folks of just how critical what happens in Des Moines and the state house is.
Yes.
Sir?
How do we reverse this kind of manufactured budget crisis that we've seen? $1 billion surplus a few years ago, and all away tax cuts and tax credits, and all of a sudden we don't have money for basic stuff.
It's what you call in baseball an unforced error. This budget crisis is an unforced error. It's a self-inflicted crisis. It's manufactured, I think, just like you said. And what we've got is we've damaged our revenue stream to where we really don't know where the money's going. And the biggest culprit right now are these tax credits, right? We've got about 400 million tax credits that are on the books now. Then we've also got, the Register did an article looking at 2010. They came up with an astronomical number. It's like $12 billion in 1 year. And I asked Representative Grassley, who's the appropriations chair, I said, "Why are we taking all these cuts out of social programs, human service type programs? Because we made up this budget deficit that we're in, about $115 million. We made it up by cutting things that help working families, right? We took it away from regional universities, we took it away from public education, we took it away, one of the most heartbreaking ones, we took it away from a program that assists families who are with their living expenses while they're treating for cancer.
Yeah.
All right? I mean, that's just cruel.
Yeah.
But we didn't even look at some of these tax credits that are out there. And we really don't know whether we're getting a return on investment for these tax credits, because from a fiscal standpoint, a tax credit is really an expenditure, right? It's a liability on the books. And we don't have control of it. And we need to look, if we're gonna give this tax credit to the renewable industry or the solar industry or some sort of industry, we need to be making sure that the state is getting a good deal out of that credit. It's not happening. Some of those credits are things, like the earned income credit, that helps working families under certain income levels. That's not something that I would put on the table, but there are other, there's 330 million other credits that we could be examining. They're just out of control. That's not the answer to everything, but it would have been a good start this year.
Yeah. Earned income credit is the first one they'll get rid of. I guarantee it.
Don't we have a rainy day fund?
No.
Well,
the rainy day fund.
Yeah, and the rainy day fund wasn't taxed. because I think, you know, probably for, I would guess for, the governor would have seen that as an admission of failure.
Was that Reagan?
Yes, ma'am.
You just said we don't have control over these tax credits. Who does?
Yeah.
Ramsdale.
Well, I mean, well, we need to get that.
And who clarifies that is we don't have, I guess another way of saying is we don't have oversight as to whether they're working, right?
Yeah.
There's no things like sunsets on them. You know, they're indefinite. Many of them are indefinite, not all of them, but they're indefinite. And then we just don't know whether they're creating, you know, you make a credit, you're trying to grow, you know, help some sort of industry grow. So we really don't have an idea if that's working, right, for most of these credits.
How did they get started in the first place? Through the legislative process?
Yeah.
Right, thank you.
Oh, yes.
You talked about how we need a slow burn of activism. One phenomenon, I think most of the people in this room have been involved in politics for a long time, so we've seen good elections and bad elections. But I've seen a lot of people who are energized for the first time this year, and it's exciting, but one thing that concerns me is, for example, the Planned Parenthood bill. Hundreds of people showed up at the State House. I knew, you know, what I call mom friends who were never active in politics before, never did anything like that before. They went to the State House to say, you know, don't defund Planned Parenthood. And I watched the conversations on social media, and some of these people were very disappointed that no one listened. And I tried to explain to them, and the same thing with the collective bargaining. You know, why weren't they listening? I tried to explain. We're going to lose a lot of battles this year, and it doesn't mean that you wasted your time and effort. But how do we keep people from getting disengaged and just giving up that hope that you were talking about?
I mean, it's
tell them elections matter.
Yes. Yes.
That's well said. Yeah. You know, when I go to forums, you know, you kind of get like new people every once in a while. And I'm talking kind of before November of 16. You know, you go to a forum, you have kind of the same group. Once in a while, you get somebody who was kind of new to a forum because they had a particular issue that they felt, you know, should be addressed. And, you know, sometimes just because they're kind of new to the system and maybe, you know, in high school civics or something, they didn't quite, you know, explain or whatever. You know, they kind of think, well, you're the state representative for us. You can just change it, right? And, you know, the fact is, it takes 51 in the House, it takes 26 in the Senate, and it takes the governor's signature, right? And it just gets back to this engagement, this continual engagement that we're not going to quit. You know, we know, we're going to fight the good fight this year, but we don't have the votes, you know? But we're going to plant the flag, we're going to stand where we believe, and we're going to fight the good fight. And that's, we're going to lead by example that way, you know, in the legislature. And we just need to continue these people, you know, to say, elections matter, and we can change this. And if you want to see this change, then we need people to run who are good candidates for dog catcher, for city council, for supervisors, for the
board,
the conservation boards, for the House, for the Senate, for the governor's office, right? I mean, that's what it is, and that's how we get this slow burn. It's just, you know, increasing readership of Leading Heartland and Starting Line. My wife saw this and she told me, like, subscriptions to the New York Times went up.
Yeah.
Anyway, here, because like the amount of subscriptions for the New York Times went up by like thousands.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know, that's what we need. We need more newspaper readers, more, you know, more news readers.
Yeah.
That was well played, by the way.
Yeah. No, you're
wrong. So I'd like to just follow up on that because I think it's really important for those of us in this room to remember why it's so important to thank our representatives and our senators. And when I thank Marty and Janet this week, they both emailed me back within 6 hours in my email. And I think that is what we need to tell people. If you don't feel like you're being heard, you keep asking, you keep calling, you keep emailing. And then if they don't answer you, that's a real indicator, you know. Yeah. And the ones that do answer you, I think we have to just keep thanking them.
Something is happening right now, you know, on Saturdays and Friday evenings across the state, that Republicans who were challenged in Harlan or wherever are being now challenged.
Yes.
And that's a first. That's a huge step, right? And that's what, you know, the thing is that we'll get new activists and people who find their voice, like I think you said your daughter, your niece. And it will make these people think twice. You know, because Republicans 30 years ago wouldn't have done this. They passed this legislation 4 years ago, right?
They were in the majority when it passed.
Yes, they had a trifecta, right? They had the House, the Senate, and the governor's office with Governor Ray when they passed the bill we just got.
But Terry Branstad voted against it.
Yeah.
Notably.
Yes, ma'am.
Years ago, when my daughter was in college, I attended a banking conference, and one of Bush's cabinet members addressed our group. Bankers. Don't let your daughters grow up to be attorneys, accountants, or doctors. What we need is more mothers. We need more women to produce more children so that we have a future tax base.
Oh. Hey, girl.
So I'm against parenting that's been going on for a very long time. And taking away any type of insurance coverage or birth control or family planning. This has been in the works for a long time. And now you talked about United being able to contribute their money to campaigns. And now we're looking at churches asking to have the ability to deliver on political talk and not lose.
You know, and what's so sad, and I think, you know, a generation fought for what we have in terms of.
I remember.
Right? Well, thank you. Yeah. And I know you're not about to let it go quietly, right?
We all know.
Right?
That's right.
And we need to let them hold them accountable for this.
Yeah.
You know, you've got Janet and Marty will have our day in the house.
Yes.
But that's what we're fighting for. And we're going to, you know, the fact of the matter is we don't have a vote. We're not going to go down quiet. And we just need to make sure people remember in November, right?
Yes.
That's the point of all this. Because now we are setting the stage to say, oh, you remember when you defunded this? You remember when you didn't support public schools? You remember when you didn't support working people?
Yeah.
Well, now you need to atone for that, right?
Yes.
And that's, you know, that's what we need to do. It needs to be a slow burn. It's a marathon, not a sprint.
Let's do one more question.
Christian has...
So we're seeing this overreach by the Republicans, not just at the legislature, but also, you know, at the federal level. When is the darkness going to end? Where are we going to see them level off in their overreach? You've got Planned Parenthood, you've got education, collective bargaining, voter IDs coming in, you've got a couple gun laws, you've got the anti-sanctuary bill. Do we have anything where is off limits to them? I'm talking about our judicial system when it comes into merit-based. We're talking about redistricting and getting rid of the what is basically a federally recognized
I wish I knew.
Yeah.
You know, I wish I knew because we kind of get bombarded.
Yeah.
You know, like this voter ID bill. It's just kind of like it's every day. And so, when is it going to end? I don't know, but it's going to end in November of 18.
Is there anything that they're at least saying, I mean, privately or at least to y'all? I mean, what, you know, in previous legislative sessions, there was at least some camaraderie, at least there was some bipartisan on some issues. Are we going to see anything like that with any big idea issues? Well, there's some bipartisanship?
That's been really the tenor change, the tone change in the House and probably in the Senate. I mean, we used to work, you know, kind of across, because we had split chambers. And so, you know, when I had my senator, I could go across the rotunda and say, hey, what, you know, is this bill gonna see the light of day here? And you know, and I could kind of broker deals on some issues between the Senate and the House. I haven't been, I think one time have I been approached by a Republican this year for input, and it was on a really, I think that on the possible texting while driving, because I'm a former prosecutor, you know, and I think that they wanted a little input from my perspective on that. I just really haven't had substantive conversations about legislation. They just don't need us.
But you never knew when the war was going to end either. But you kept on fighting.
That's right.
That's right.
That, just that keep on fighting.
one more question.
If I may, the point raised by the lady in the back deserves more amplification, I think, because it's extremely important. I mean, one of the things that for us as progressives, especially, that those ideas are so bizarre and unrelated to anything in the world in which we live, that we cannot wrap our minds around that notion. And so we refuse to take them seriously, but they really do believe, honest to God, that women should be barefoot and pregnant.
Yeah.
That's what they believe. They really do believe that white people should control the economy and the means of production, and people of color should be subservient to the role of white people. They really do believe that fundamentalist churches should dictate the policy of the political entities within the United States. We have got to come to terms with that, understand it, and call it what it is to begin with, and articulate, you know, a position dramatically different from that.
There's what's, you know, I'll leave you with this thought, right? There's a philosopher, John Stuart Mill, right? Remember? John Stuart Mill. And he always talked about the marketplace of ideas, right?
Yes.
And the marketplace of ideas, in so many words, is where a bad idea goes to die, right?
Yeah.
We need to create the marketplace of ideas over the next 2 years, and as long as we want to keep this democracy working, we need to have a vibrant marketplace of ideas.
Yes.
We need to let these bad ideas die.
Yes.
And we do that because we have to fight.
Yes.
All right? This has really been fun. It's a good group here.
Oh, yeah.
Stay active. It's a marathon, not a sprint.
Yes.
We're going to get them in 18. Thank you very much.